Ayurveda or just rituals in themselves. It doesn't have to be Ayurveda, but just rituals and being healthy and understanding the link between, you know, having a pause in life and having a pause in your day and understanding that actually we need to focus on what makes us happy, not just work and kind of getting into the drill of life, pausing and doing that yoga class, pausing and pausing when you eat and understanding the link between food and mood. All of that kind of culminated in this book.
Hey everyone, welcome back to For Soul's Sake, a podcast in which I desire to give you candid conversation on spirituality and holistic wellness alongside a host of amazing guests. Thanks to each and every one of you that comes back to listen, learn, and grow with us. I'm curious about people's stories. I'm curious about how people find healing. I'm curious about how creativity and self-expression can sometimes be the best medicine for what we're going through in life. And I want you to hear from people of different backgrounds and walks of life so that you could familiarize yourself and connect with those people, your story in their stories. Hopefully this podcast makes you feel heard. Hopefully it makes you feel seen. I hope it makes you feel understood. And today's guest is Mira Manik, an author of two books, founder of the famous Chai by Mira, featured chef within Stylist, Red Magazine, and The Independent. Her journey in health, wellness, and food started when she moved back to London and rediscovered vegetarian and vegan recipes she grew up eating from her mother and grandmother's Gujarati kitchen. Having suffered from digestion issues, irritable bowel syndrome, and becoming obsessed with dieting, Mira looked for a healthier way of eating and developed a love for yoga, breathwork, and Ayurveda. She's brought her family's recipes to life and created lighter and wholesome Indian dishes in her first book, Saffron Soul. And her second book, Prajna, focuses on Ayurveda and rituals for happiness. Mira is also an integrated health practitioner, a discipline that combines nutritional science, naturopathy, Chinese medicine, Eastern philosophy, and Ayurveda to treat physical, mental, and emotional disorders, and is known globally for her delicious recipes and holistic wellness advice. Mira, thank you for all you do. It's truly amazing. These kind of accolades and the kind of things that you've been up to in the last few years, it's truly impressive. And how accessible and relevant you make Ayurveda and healthy, vegetarian, vegan, traditional cuisine, I think it's pretty awesome. I really respect that. Thank you so much for all that you do.
Thank you. And thanks for the amazing introduction.
Of course. I wanted to get stuck in. You kind of fell into this path when you moved back to London. And I just want to hear about how that journey started for you and what kind of gave you the drive to make Ayurveda more relevant and accessible for people.
So losing my own way in health and thinking I was incredibly healthy, thinking, you know, I need to get thinner and that equals healthy.
Wow.
I literally thought that. I mean, I was on a mission to, you know, get skinny basically for so many years. And I moved back to London, but just before I moved back, I was in India and I was sitting on the street having a coffee. I'm pretty sure I was in Bandra. I was in Starbucks sitting and having a coffee. And it dawned on me suddenly that I have come to India so many times with snacks in my bag.
Yeah.
And why would I do that? Indian food is healthy. What, where did I lose the whole notion of Indian food being healthy? And why do people globally think of it as not a necessarily healthy cuisine? Mm. So that's when I thought, I grew up eating really healthy food. Why did I let go of it? And that's when I sort of lost my way in health, because I was reading all these papers, being bombarded with magazines and media telling me that you need to have low fat and hence you're then getting addicted to sugar. I did Weight Watchers for a whole year or longer. I did the point system, you know, during my university years, and I did lose weight. But I remember feeling like unsure about, you know, my energy dips, for example, because I'd have sugar and then I didn't understand it. Didn't understand what sugar was doing to my body. And I had acne and I was losing hair. So obviously I was not nutritionally filling myself. I wasn't having the kind of nutrition that you need at that age or any age. Mm. And so many years later, it dawned on me that I need to go back to eating the food that I grew up eating. And I want to tell the world about that. And so I started this with this notion that I wanted to write a book, because I've always loved books. I'd already written, actually, back in the day, I'd written a guidebook on Dubai and I'd written a novel, which I never published. I love writing. So I thought, I want to write a cookbook. So I thought, let me write a cookbook. And obviously, it's not going to happen overnight, but I thought it would be quite easy. So I went about learning all the recipes that I'd grew up eating, that I'd grown up eating from my mom, from my grandmother, from my aunts in the same house. I moved back home and I asked them, how are these things are made? And they're such simple things that they make every day.
Mm.
And yet I was like, well, how much of this? And they're like, well, we don't know how much. Like, you know, you just put in whatever feels right. And they were getting irritated by me, but I did it. And then it took a while. It took time to get to that stage where I actually then published that book. So the long of the short is it came about because of my lack of understanding of what health meant.
Mm.
And in that process, in that journey of finding myself, and as you know, in my second book, I delve into the story of how and why I moved back to London, i.e. getting a divorce and going through a very long process of getting a divorce and going through a very lonely period in life. Mm. I was living in Dubai, I was living in Uganda, I was traveling all over the world, and actually I was completely alone. So I start my second book, Prajna, writing about that. And I think Ayurveda, or just rituals in themselves, it doesn't have to be Ayurveda, but just rituals and being healthy, yeah, and understanding the link between, you know, having a pause in life and having a pause in your day, and understanding that actually we need to focus on what makes us happy, not just work and kind of getting into the drill of life, pausing and doing that yoga class, pausing and pausing when you eat, and understanding the link between food and mood. All of that kind of culminated in this book.
Wow.
And also bringing together my own journey in spirituality, in life, and happiness. What inspires happiness?
Wow, that's really, I mean, that was a really conclusive and full answer of where it all started. And I kind of want to peel it away a little bit, because I think you're a great example of someone that's experienced some hardship. You know, you spoke briefly just then about going through a divorce, and you've written about it in your second book. And you also mentioned how you felt lonely in a space in Uganda, Dubai, and all your traveling efforts, which honestly, from the outside, it kind of looks kind of cool that you're traveling the world. Everyone kind of wants that, right? The wanderlust of traveling the world.
And I was a travel journalist at the time.
I had no
idea. I loved it.
That's amazing. But going from there to then experiencing, okay, something that most people would say is not a positive experience, and then turning that into an opportunity to serve others. And that was the main reason that I think I invited you here, because I think I really love stories where people have gone through moments of perhaps rock bottoms and learnt from them, or realised from them, that actually this life is meant for more than just simply trying to travel the world and fill the bank balance. And, you know, there has to be a deeper purpose. So, I mean, your hope story, maybe you can share a little bit about that. Like, what gave you hope in that moment of perhaps, yeah, not feeling that everything was going your way?
It's really hard to think back to what, how I felt then, but it was a pretty dark place, and I think it lasted for a very long time. But what I do remember very well is waking up each day and knowing that I need to focus on doing a few things that make me happy.
Wow.
So it doesn't matter that my entire day I might be crying and feeling upset and sad and lost. If I can just do a few things that make me happy, like that, you know, in Dubai, it was a spinning class, perhaps, or going for a walk in the sun and sitting in the sun and reading a book or whatever it was. I don't remember what I was doing at the time.
Mm.
And writing made me very happy at that time. So it was hard, but it was a cathartic process, you know, and writing, it's always a way for me to get emotions onto paper. And it wasn't writing about me. I was writing a novel at the time. So actually, it was an amazing process, of a liberating process. And also, I got lost in that writing.
Wow.
And it helped me to distract myself. And thirdly, also meeting. I mean, I didn't have that many friends in Dubai, but the odd time I would meet a friend, that would help. So it was just focusing on the little things. And mainly, I would say yoga lifted me.
Wow.
Because at the time, I was also the editor, or I just stopped being the editor of the first yoga magazine in the Middle East, Yoga Life. So as a result of becoming the editor of Yoga Life, I was in the yoga society, and I knew everyone, and I had my favorite teachers, and I went to classes. I did some private classes. Mm. I did classes on the beach, and I just delved into yoga at the time. So I think that's what lifted me.
Finding the moments of hope.
Finding moments each day that can lift you.
Yeah. I think the mind is interesting, right? Like, the analogy is given that if you have a piece of corn stuck in your teeth, then you've got, I don't know how many teeth, 30 plus teeth in your mouth. but your tongue will always go to have a feel of that piece of corn that's stuck in your teeth. And I think sometimes the mind can be like that we just focus so much on that which is in one sense irrelevant or small, and keep trying to push and nudge that thing, forgetting that there's all of these opportunities and spaces within the mouth. If you get the analogy, it's kind of seeing, rather than focusing on the dark sky, focus on the moon. Focus on that which will bring you hope.
Yeah, but that's definitely much easier said than done. And sure. I think I wasn't necessarily focusing on the happy moments. I was just making sure that I did things every day that would lift me a bit. Mm. Because now I understand. Then I didn't understand that what was working in a yoga class or in a spin class would be the endorphins that would make me feel happier. Mm. I didn't know about endorphins at the time. Now I do. Now I understand why exercise helped me. Mm. Or sitting in the sun, you get dopamine, you get like vitamins, you just feel happier. Mm. There's a reason. There's a scientific reason for that. But it's hard to say that I'm focusing on that and ignoring what's going on in my life. All that was in my mind was what was going on in my life. But by having a few moments that distracted me and made me happy, I was able to collectively find, 3 hours in the day where I could do things that made me happy.
Mm.
So, but that doesn't mean to say that I became happy in those days. It just means that I focused on a few things that I could continue. And that's why I write in my second book about rituals. And whether you're going through a happy time or a sad time, it's important to have a few rituals that you continue and you make a habit of, so that when you're in your happy times, it'll just lift you and make and provide you with sort of an element of groundedness or happiness or whatever it is. But actually those same rituals, when you go through a dark time in life, which we all will help lift you out of that maybe quicker.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'm not a writer. Never have I written. I don't plan on writing anytime soon in the future, but would there be any advice? I mean, you seem to be very natural with picking up a pen and paper and expressing yourself in that way. Would you have any advice for anyone that maybe, because it seems quite a healing journey to write for you. And I think many people can, even without having experienced that, can also get that this is an experience or a practice that will bring me some sort of healing. Would you have any advice for anyone that's starting to write or has a dream to write one day?
Absolutely. I think writing, firstly, is very inspired. Yeah. I mean, it doesn't always have to be. But when you're doing some sort of travel writing or creative writing, you want to be in that moment. So try, and I try this as much as possible, is writing when I'm inspired. So if I'm feeling really sad or really happy or really inspired by what's in front of me or the experience I'm having, I will try and get my phone out right there and then and just jot down what I'm like, what it is and what I'm feeling. I remember going to see the gorillas in Uganda once. And I was, at the time, I was writing a column for the Gulf News. I was a columnist at the time. And I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. But I knew if I didn't capture that moment, I would forget like the water on those leaves or my feet, on the leaves rustling, making the leaves rustle, or the feeling of slight cold or whatever it was. I can't remember right now. But I got my phone out there and then I started writing everything down because I knew that if I didn't capture that moment, it's like a photograph, a snapshot. If you don't capture it there and then, how are you going to recreate it? You can get that feeling back, but it's much harder. So if as a writer, you want to write creatively or in an inspired way, try and, if you can, do it at the time or just after the special experience you've had. And as for healing, I think there's a lot to be said, and people talk a lot on Instagram and online about journaling. Mm. And I haven't journaled a lot. I do journal, but not on a regular basis. But I think, and that's something I do write about in Prajna as a ritual. I think it's a really great ritual to have especially when you're going through a hard time. But you can do it anytime, getting the emotions out. Sometimes the tangle of emotions in our mind, the tangle of thoughts in our mind, it doesn't allow us to see beyond it. It doesn't allow us to see things objectively.
Wow.
And so writing it down diffuses some of that emotion so that you can see it objectively. And you think, oh, actually, why am I so worried about that, actually? It's not as big a deal as it felt in my head when you write it down. Yeah. It's like talking to a friend. It offloads it. And so writing it down is a process of healing or a process of untangling thoughts and emotions.
I love that. I love that. How friends are people who we consider good sources of moments of offloading, and you can kind of see things with different perspective, but also how you've kind of likened that to writing and how that can also be a healing process by expelling thoughts that you perhaps don't need to carry, that don't serve you anymore. I think that's quite cool. You spoke about rituals, and I want to get into that. Was there any spiritual or religious or, what was the kind of inspiration behind calling it a ritual, a daily ritual?
Ritual is a lovely word. I think it feels very inspired. It feels like, habit feels like something that could be a chore. I think a ritual just feels more inspired, like it has more meaning. It has a purpose. It's habit with a purpose.
Habit with a purpose. I like that.
I think. Yeah. So I feel like ritual is a nice word. It could be a practice. Mm. You know, what's your daily practice? Mm. It's a bit like that. But ritual feels a bit more purposeful.
Any rituals that you think would really change the world if every single person implemented them?
I think the basic ones, really. So waking up and, for example, one of the things I write about is, so my book is divided in chapters of morning, afternoon, evening. And in the morning section, it's about waking up and smiling, for example. Mm-hmm. Now, that seems really basic.
Yeah.
But we don't do that. And if we're going through a happy time or a sad time, we're not going to wake up and smile for no reason. Okay, we might if our child's next to us, or, right. You know,
even
like,
then.
Oh, wow, my husband or my wife is, maybe. But, and if something makes you laugh, but essentially you don't wake up and think, I need to smile. But actually the act of smiling, if you read all the studies, there's a lot to be said about the physiological act of smiling, which makes you psychologically feel happier.
Right.
So just smiling, even when you're going through a really bad time, forcing yourself to do it, automatically makes you potentially feel slightly happier. And so if you start your day like that, there's a lot to be said about starting a day with a positive attitude, and that can, I don't think smiling can do any harm. And that's why they have laughing yoga. Like if you go to, I don't know if they have it here, but obviously in Bombay and India and places, I've seen groups of people come together and they're just laughing away in the morning.
I've seen that.
And it's amazing. And firstly, it's great for the breath. It's great for the body. But you're actually causing yourself to laugh. And it feels initially forced, maybe, but actually it's quite natural because everyone laughing around you, you're going to just end up laughing. And that can do only good because you're starting your day off on a positive note. So laughing, smiling, and that's very, you know, that's the initial basic stuff. Mm. Now, what you do, singing, that's another ritual I write about, listening to ragas first thing in the morning.
Wow.
And that's how I grew up, you know, listening to morning ragas that my dad would put on.
Beautiful.
First thing in the morning. So actually having that as a ritual, like it just goes on first thing, is quite a nice way to start the day because you're having mantras flowing in the background, or whatever you want.
I mean, I maintain that if the whole world would wake up and chant and dance, we'd live in a happier place. I think, you know, I think the challenge, though, is realistically, we live in a world which is pretty chaotic. And to build habits that are positive reinforcers, rituals that are positive enforcers, it sounds almost romantic and it sounds like, yeah, in an ideal world, if my work wasn't this much and I didn't have this much in terms of family responsibility, then maybe I'd try them.
Yes, but these are very small things that I'm talking about. So, yeah, I agree. You know, doing yoga 3 times a week, going to this class or that class, you need to carve time out for that. And I think that's very important. In fact, that's one of the main, I wouldn't call it a ritual, but I've called it a ritual in my book. It's a practice. It's something that you do every day, some type of movement, because you should do movement. Our bodies need to move.
Yeah.
Walking, connecting with nature, doing high energy movement, doing yoga, breathing, all those things are important. You can take little elements of them. If you can't do breath work every day, it doesn't matter. Do 5 minutes in the morning. Just do a few deep breaths and that will help you just have a better, more peaceful day because your mind will be more at ease. Or just the smile. I mean, that doesn't take any effort or time. If you're going to work, can you leave 5 minutes earlier and take an extra 5 minute walk so that you're just walking a little bit more?
Yeah.
You know, just trying to fit those little things into your day. But I would say don't take on 10 things in the first week or in any week. You should really just take one thing on and make that a habit before you launch onto the next thing. Because if you take too many things on and they just seem you're excited to start with, and then you just end up being overwhelmed by it and not do it, you will not go back to it.
Right.
So start off really small. And I think there's different areas of life that you need to focus on. It's not just, obviously, smiling is one, breathing, movement, eating well, having gaps between meals, understanding how digestion works, because that is the crux of everything. You know, digestion is where it all begins. Disease, most diseases start with issues in digestion. So you want to focus on making sure that your gut is healthy. And stress is the main thing. And what affects stress? Sleep, what's going on in our lives, how much we have on in our minds constantly. Body stress, you know, too much exercise. It could be anything. Yeah. Food can cause inflammation, which causes stress. So any kind of stress can lead to a lot of issues and disease.
Yeah.
So trying to make sure that you're doing everything you can to prevent stress in your life, I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah. So you almost have to become conscious of that which pains you first. You have to become conscious that this is clearly a problem. So therefore, let me try and do something about it. Sometimes I think we become so numb to living in a automatic mode that we just forget to be conscious and aware that this is something that I need to do in order to be more alive, to be more joyful in life. And, you know, whenever someone gives me the excuse like, Radhika, I'm way too stressed out or too busy to do chanting or all the stuff that you're promoting. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, no one has ever gone to a hospital when they're feeling well. You know, you don't hear someone go to a restaurant, for example, when they're full. No one eats at home and then goes out to a restaurant to eat a second time. Or no one goes to the hospital in full health. I'm coming. I'm fully healthy. Just give me whatever you're going to give me because that doesn't make any sense logically. So in the same way, if you're stressed out, if you're too busy, that's a sign you need to meditate more. That's a sign you really need to change something. And in the same way, I think people who say they don't have time for positive reinforcement rituals that will daily bring you to a happier state of consciousness because they're too busy, it's almost like an oxymoron. You kind of expect it more. You need it more in your life. And I think it stems from the point of being more conscious, being more aware. And we live in this kind of age, or you know, people are talking about a woke state of affairs in the UK, and people are becoming awakened to the needs of the body and the mind. But I think there's space for more of it. You know, it'd be so cool if the Prime Minister went out and said, "Yeah, I'm stressed out, and this is what I'm doing to counteract it," rather than just pretending that there's no such thing as stress. You know, completely ignoring the fact that people are experiencing anxiety, depression, frustration, you know, so many other things that are causing, you know, bodily pain, mental pain, pains in the heart, emotional pain. So I think that there can't be enough conversation on how to deal with these small things, like implementing 5 minute smiling, 5 minute gratitude journaling. You know, I think that
gratitude is a good one. I was about to say that the first thing in the morning, if you can, or last thing at night, you know, going to sleep or waking up on a note where you are counting your blessings, because actually there's a lot going wrong in everyone's lives.
Right.
But can you count those three or four things in the day that have gone right and that you're happy about and that you're actually grateful for? So finding them, and that will shift your mindset over time. It may not shift your mindset in one day, but if you practice that every day, and again, it can be a long process. You can write it down and explain it, but it can be a 2 minute thing.
2 minutes. Yeah. It's the same as prayer. Like, people talk about prayer and say, I don't know how to pray. I don't, you know, the words don't come to my mind in a poetic way. I'm like, that's fine. Just, even if you just say, thanks, God, or, I mean, we'll get into the topic of God in a second, but thanks, almighty, supreme, divine, whatever it is that you call it, just a small thank you can shift your consciousness miles away from where it was. You know, just those small words, thank you, I appreciate, I'm grateful for, one line, one word.
And it's often like when I've broken a couple of, once I broke my ankle, and then the other time I broke something in my foot. And every time I've broken something in my body, I feel like it's always been my feet. I suddenly feel like you realize the importance of that thing. So if it was my wrist or if it was my finger, you'd be like, oh my God, I can't do X, Y, and Z without it. But without your foot, there's a lot you can't do. And being on crutches makes you realize how grateful I am and I should be in my day-to-day life for even being able to walk. And I'm not saying that as a every night you have to thank God for the limbs that he's given you. But it's just about being conscious of how being healthy is, how important being healthy is.
Mm.
And it's only when your health or something's taken away from you that you realize its value. So remember to stay healthy, because and remember that the mind will affect what's going on physically. And if the physical is a manifestation sometimes and very often of what's going on in the life, in life and in your mind.
Mm, beautiful. Should we talk about God?
Yeah, sure.
Who or what is God for you?
I have my own sort of prayers that I say and mantras. And often the mantras that you chant are very much the mantras that I chant. And so that I recognize them and I love them. And I love Kirtan for that reason. So it's very much, I guess, what you chant. And Krishna, Shiva, Ram. You know, I grew up, I went to a school which taught the Ramayana. Well, taught Sanskrit.
Cool.
And the only school in London that teaches Sanskrit. So I grew up reading verses of the Ramayana and translating the Mahabharata. I also went to the same school where we went to church, and it was a very sort of inclusive school, but it was based on the teachings of the Shankaracharya of India. And so we studied scriptures, and I loved that. And that's very ingrained in my life. And I grew up in a very cultural family, you know, where we do these pujas. My grandmother still does them. And while I don't always understand the relevance, I do now more than I used to. I think just growing up doing these things have cemented them in my life and in my mind, and I do love all things Indian.
Amazing.
And it's a crossover of religion, spirituality, and culture.
Yeah, I mean, you spoke about mantras, and I think something I'm seeing more and more of is those that aren't indigenous to mantra, like those who are not of an Indian origin or of any Vedic origin, are coming to chant mantra at the kirtan sessions we have on Friday night. And it's been revolutionary seeing that. Why do you think that, you know, so many people are turning to, you know, in one sense, unorthodox ways of connecting with God? Like in the Christian religion, there's not really much in the way of chanting mantras. They have hymns, and I guess the concept is similar. But do you perhaps have an understanding of why so many people are turning towards, you know, less traditional Christian methods and trying Eastern philosophy? Because we're kind of in a situation where we've both been brought up around that.
Yeah. But most people, I would say 80% of the people who've been brought up around that don't necessarily embrace it.
Fully. Maybe even 90%. I've experienced that.
But it's other people that are embracing it as well, which is really wonderful to see. I think it's because I don't see what could be called Hinduism, although I don't call it Hinduism, as a very exclusive thing, religion, spiritual. I don't even feel like it's much of a religion as much as it is a way of life or spirituality or what you feel. And I think whether it's a church, a gurudwara, a mosque, a temple, whatever you go into, or even just an inspiring space, when you feel the divine or presence of the divine, that's what matters.
Right.
So it's what you connect with. And I think people are connecting maybe with that Eastern way of chanting and realizing that there is something in that that's elevating them.
Yeah.
And maybe yoga has been a route to direct them
definitely
that way.
Definitely has, yeah.
Because it opens up those channels potentially, makes it seem less alien, as it were. It probably is that.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned this, that the detail of how you perform or what rituals you perform is less important now, whereas the principles are more prominent. I think previously in like the 80s or 90s, there was a bit of a fear around Vedic culture, Hinduism, Indian culture, because it seemed a bit idol worshipy and quite alien. And I think that was because there was a focus on detail, whereas now I think there's a voice and an opening for people to understand the principles behind what these rituals are, essentially.
Yeah, but I also think going into cultural appropriation and appreciation, all of that, that's become such a big deal. Yeah. I think since the Black Lives Movement, right? It's become Black Lives Matter Matters Movement. It's become a bigger deal. And I think people are talking about it a lot on Instagram. I don't agree with all of it. I think sometimes there has to be room for the motive, the sort of pow behind something, as opposed to pronouncing something really properly. Some people say, oh, you're not pronouncing, the white teacher isn't pronouncing
Namaste
the mantra
properly.
She doesn't really understand the meaning. I just don't think it matters. She's not saying it in a bad way.
Sure. I think that people are focusing way too much on the detail than the principle.
Yeah.
The detail can be shifted. Like, for example, I present mantra, kirtan, I pronounce it in different ways. Like right now I'm saying mantra, but when I'm in a session, I'll say mantra because it's more pronounced. People can associate with that. I could be doing that in robes with a shaved head, without a beard, even though I love it, with markings on my forehead, tilak on my forehead. I could do it like that. Or I could be conscious that if I want people to experience joy and I want to open that up to as many people as possible, there have to be some details that you have to exclude. There have to be some details which you can be willing to shift the line on so that it accesses more people to the practice.
Also, there has to be no rules, as it were.
Sure.
Not no rules, but, you know.
Yeah.
Not. We're not talking about modest, like immodest or disrespect. I think that's where cultural appropriation does come
exactly.
in. We don't want to be rude, or sorry, not rude, disrespectful to a culture.
Yeah.
That I completely agree with. But I don't think you need to understand every element of everything to be able to embrace it.
Otherwise, I probably wouldn't be practicing myself.
Well, I mean, I went to a school from the age of four, which the only school in the UK that taught Sanskrit. And all the teachers, all the Sanskrit teachers nearly that taught me were all English.
Wow.
And they understood, they pronounced things amazingly. But they did do the ta rather than the ta, but I don't think that matters. Their pronunciation of the Sanskrit words was absolutely perfect. And it still is. I mean, the school is still there. So do I look back on that and say, oh, they said om burburvaha swaha, which was actually wrong because I say om burburvaha swaha. Like, but no, I don't do that because actually they did pronounce it well. It's just their sort of T, their enunciation of T is T rather than the.
I mean,
who really cares?
Exactly. I think so. I think I'm of that opinion as well. I think we share similar opinions on that. Can I ask you, what do you struggle with when it comes to spirituality? Do you have any struggles with spirituality? Do you have any inner, anything that causes friction when we talk about spirituality? Or is there anything that kind of turns you off from spiritual communities?
I think it's obviously hard to define when spirituality sort of starts and religion ends, because it's all to do, they're both very much interlinked. And religion in some ways, in some spheres, can seem what people would call cultish. So that potentially could put people off. And but I have my own way of worshipping, praying, feeling whatever I feel. And I feel I'm very, very open to experiencing that same or getting that same feeling in other ways, not just one way. And I think the more open you become, the more you realize that the world has a lot to offer. But that said, my roots are Indian and I'm very Indian at heart. And I love going back to India. I go 2-3 times a year and I find everything I want in terms of inspiration there.
Amazing. Yeah, I guess.
But I do love walking into a church. I do love, you know, going to a church service. I do go to midnight mass almost every year on the 24th, wherever I am in the world. I love it. So I do feel that you can find that same sense of peace in different cultures in different ways.
Yeah, it's like the analogy that's given by Bhaktivedanta Swami. He says that there may be many airlines going to a destination. Let's just call it Mumbai because we're talking about India. There may be many different airlines, Virgin Atlantic, Air India, what other airlines? American Airlines, I don't know if they fly there. But there's, you get the point. Many different airlines flying to one destination. Some may take a different route to others, flying in this cloud altitude, others in that altitude. Some may take a stopover, some may take two stopovers, some may be direct, etc. is the destination the same? Yes. So in one sense, we have to kind of realize that even if this person that I'm sitting across in a conversation about spirituality, in a conversation about religion, doesn't practice the same way I practice, but if you ask them about the goal, and the goal is love God, love thy fellow neighbors, you know, like love each other, see the similarities as opposed to the differences, et cetera, et cetera, then I think there is scope for appreciating each other. Like, I think we live in a climate where there is definitely a lot of hate based on what you practice.
Yeah.
And I think that that does create you and I are different mentality. And I think that we focus so much on the differences in rituals that sometimes we forget that the principles in which we're searching for are almost identical. And I think that we can learn to live to appreciate each other more. And I think it's a sticking point for many people to, you know, the negativity surrounding divide. I think that that's something that we need to work on as a whole community, as a world community. Because I know that, I don't know if you've heard about what's happening in Birmingham,
yeah,
and Leicester. It's quite horrific. And I just wish that there was more voice on seeing, yeah, that we're loving the same God, you know. That
very sad.
Yeah, it's very sad.
It's almost like don't really understand the purpose of all that. I mean, I don't know where it's come from. Like, where does that sort of thing come from?
Yeah, I think if you're asking me, I'd say it comes from probably conditioning, that people have been conditioned to think a certain way. Like, you know, if we talk about holy war and jihad, then it's not a case of that person perhaps is wrong. It's just a case of they've been conditioned to think this is the only way in which they will attain a higher state of liberation. So I don't blame them. It's just conditioning. They've been brought in a certain culture. I think the nature of all people innately is to love. But I think that because of conditioning, of the way in which we are, A, brought up, B, the people that we surround ourselves with in our adult lives, you know, teenage adult lives, and I think the practices, the rituals which we have daily, I think those all culminate in our belief structure being built as, I think this way and it's the only way. And when I hear someone say the only way, I kind of flinch a little bit because I'm like, ooh, I wish you didn't say that. Because there's so many ways to the same goal, so many ways to Mumbai, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Mira. You're letting me do my thing and share my spirituality with the world. I'm not just a question master here tonight. So
it's just a discussion, an open discussion.
Yeah, thanks. Appreciate that. You've done a lot in the short space of time since you've started sharing about Ayurveda. I mean, I don't know how many years it's been exactly, but the world's changing constantly. There's so many different things in the way that we speak. Social media is constantly changing in terms of social norms. And you've done a lot to kind of keep yourself relevant and accessible to people. Have you had to adapt the way in which you speak, the way in which you share? What kind of tools and things have you had to get used to using in order to share your gifts with others in a better way?
Well, I think the main change has been Instagram.
Yeah.
Although Instagram came about when I started my journey. So I remember when I signed on, when I created my account, I was actually in a yoga retreat at the time and I hadn't heard about Instagram, but I had just started my food journey then. So we're talking about 8 years ago. So Instagram obviously is the main way to share, but before, I would say initially it was all about blogging, you know, putting the post up and being like, you know, and check the link in the bio.
Yeah.
It's no longer that. It's about creating everything just for Instagram. So people are just visually, you know, and now it's changed to videos. So yes, I used to be photographs and now I take a lot more videos, and getting good on camera has been a big thing.
Yeah.
So all those things, just the way you're transmitting, you're conveying your message. And for me, making that shift from being a chef or considered a chef and foodie to wellness expert, because my second book is about Ayurveda. So I needed to somehow convince publishers that I was ready to, or they should buy into this, not new version of me, but this change.
Wow.
Because essentially, if someone's writing a cookbook, they'll write another cookbook. And yes, my second book does have recipes, but it's not a cookbook.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a shift for me. But that was also very much going back to the reasons I started. Because actually, while food is an essential component of health, it was a very much a holistic lifestyle for me that I was hoping in the future sort of to convey and make make my sort of career all-rounded, not just food.
Mm. Has there been any challenge along the way? What's been your biggest challenge when it comes to sharing?
Not keeping up, feeling like I'm not doing enough and putting enough out there.
Wow.
I think that troubles me sometimes. Oh, God, I haven't put a reel up or a post up in X number of days. Because
it's
actually
hard.
You do need to be constant on that.
Yeah.
And what else? Not getting too tied up, not scrolling too much. I think now I do post and leave it, but I do go back and check. How many, you know, the comments and this and that. And I think that everyone gets caught up with, but it's about trying to make sure that you don't get too caught up with it, because actually then you spend hours just doing that sort of thing and worrying.
Yeah. It's validating hearing you say that, because I feel like that all the time. You know, just that, oh man, I need to get something up today. I haven't posted anything in a few days. Am I doing my audience, my community a disservice by not being out there enough? You know, it's always a challenge, I think, when you're trying to give to a wider audience. And I think, yeah, we can let ourselves go from time to time. Like this, for example, this weekend just gone, I just didn't look at my phone at all. I just didn't post a damn thing. And I was completely happy and content doing that. But yeah, it's definitely...
It's nice to hear from people when people say, oh, you're very authentic, or
sure,
you come across as a very, I don't know, like you put out there what you practice and that sort of thing. Because I feel like it's hard to get that across sometimes.
Yeah.
And you don't know whether you are getting that across. Because there's a lot on Instagram that's also just, not for show, but...
I get what you mean.
Like you want to be showing that you are practicing what you're preaching in a way.
I totally.
But also how do you, through the reels and the posts and all that, convey the many things that you kind of stand for? So like, you know, the food and the lifestyle and the tips. And so I find it's a hard, it's a daily sort of, oh, I need to post, I need to do this, I need to do this. Mm. But it's sort of what I do.
Yeah. It's part of our service, I guess. We have to do something to...
And balancing the many things that I want to do. You know, I feel like I get caught up in so many things, but I should focus on... Like, my mind tells me I should really focus on my business, which is the chai business. But then I want to also do this, and I'm writing a book, and I'm doing this. So it's like, you know, how do you fill your day or compartmentalize your day and structure in a way where you're doing it all?
Go easy on us, audience, you know? We're trying our best. We've got to squeeze it in into 15 seconds nowadays. You know, yeah, I totally get what you're saying. So thank you so much for sharing that. Let's move into quick fire. We're going to go into one word, one sentence answers. Number one, you ready? Okay, number one. What's something you're curious about right now?
Chai, because that's my book. I know a lot about it now.
Okay. I mean, I know it's meant to be one word, one answer, but I want to know more. What specifically about chai is kind of...
So I'm writing a book on chai, and what's been really interesting, obviously it's got recipes and all of that, but what's been really interesting is the history.
Mm.
And I've connected with some really interesting people who've written about chai as well. And the history is just fascinating. Like I could just literally spend an hour telling you about it right now, but you'll have to read my book.
Part two podcast, or read the book.
It's so fascinating.
When's it coming
because
out?
Chai doesn't come from it. Well, chai doesn't really come from India. Tea wasn't consumed in India until 1950.
Whoa. I thought it was historical, like it's always been in the culture.
Not at all. I mean, I didn't realize all this. It came from China, but it also came from the British, and it's a really fascinating history.
Mm. When's the book coming out?
Next September.
Yeah. Keep your eyes peeled. What's it called? Chai by Mira?
No, it's not called chai. It's called chai, but it's not confirmed yet.
Okay,
but
not confirmed.
It's going to be a generic book on chai as opposed to
Amazing.
A branded book on chai. It's
that
going to
be quite cool.
In bookstores and things. So yeah,
I'm looking forward to that. Next September, watch this space. Number two, what's the best advice you've received from a fellow Ayurvedic practitioner?
That's a really good question. Something I didn't know before, which is combining dairy and fruits. I didn't know that before. Wow. I wouldn't say that that's necessarily something that if you do combine, you feel the effect immediately. So it's not like not combining those two things helped me eliminate X, Y, and Z. But it's just interesting because I had no idea about it before.
Amazing. What's your favorite thing about your books?
In my first book, it's the photographs. I love them. And in my second book, it's the passages of inspiration.
Amazing.
These are not one-word answers.
That's cool. That's a one-word, one sentence. It's all good. I'm going to ask you as well, what's your least favorite thing about your books?
Oh, God. What is my least favorite thing about my books? I don't like the fact that books sometimes have a shelf life. They're not like, you know, after they've been popular for a year or two, they don't end up on the shelves anymore after a while. I mean, it depends on who you are as well.
Yeah.
That's probably what I don't like. I do like my books, and I think when I go back to them, I'm quite proud of them.
Amazing. Next question. Something you used to value but don't value anymore.
I think I would say the judgments of people. I think I got caught up in that whole do people like me thing. And everyone does at a certain point in life. And I think it consumed me. And we're talking years and years ago for a long time. But I think the more you live, the more I realize that I don't really care that much. It doesn't, obviously affects me now and again. But I practice not to worry too much about that.
Amazing. And the last one, if you could create one law that everyone in the world had to follow, what would it be?
I think it just comes down to what every faith says, which is love one another, love thy neighbor. And just pure love, really. If you come from a space of loving people, then there won't be any hatred.
Amazing. Beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing. Well, that ends our podcast today with Mira Manik. I'm really grateful that you took the time out. Thank you so much for really being here, for taking time out of the busy schedule and sharing with us so much on Ayurveda, rituals, on your spiritual thought, on how we can be of service to the world. It's really, really wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, today's episode, we were blessed to have Mira Manik here in the studio, and I hope that you valued the episode as much as I did. I want to invite you to please leave a comment on what you felt struck you the most. I want to invite you to share this podcast with a friend, share it with someone that you feel would really value it. And as always, feel the permission to listen back to it. There's so many things that get said in the podcast, and I can totally appreciate sometimes you're listening on the go, that you may miss some of the nuggets that came out that really will perhaps influence you in a positive way. So please feel permission to listen back to it. Until the next one, see you soon. For so